P-Town Couriers, LLC, a local bicycle food delivery company delivering to the Portland metro area in an hour or less. More information and a list of local eateries they work with can be found at pdxccc.com.
You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM, K296 FT West Haven, serving Portland at 107.1 FM, and K219 KU Nehalem, serving Nehalem, Manzanita, and Rockaway Beach at 91.7 FM. Streaming live and archived at xray.fm, radio is yours.
It's all about time now. Tick tock, I rock. But then I look at the clock. Knock, knock, who's there? Well, I don't dare. Open the door. Time. There was nothing but time then. Click clack riding down the tracks. Never worried about coming back. Any place looked good to me. Why not stop and see? What's there? Much time now. What's the fear? Well, I like it here with the ones I love so near. Maybe there's just some way, dear God. I can stay.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The way that the letter was written, it was very arbitrary and unlawful overreach that basically threatened the education of all Maryland students.
Kenya Campbell with the American Federation of Teachers in Maryland is celebrating a federal court for blocking the Department of Education from withholding funds over diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. President Donald Trump argues DEI initiatives brainwash students and violate the Civil Rights Act. New York Head Start programs say they're caught between delayed federal funding and a Trump administration move to bar undocumented families from the program. Susan Stamler is with United Neighborhood Houses.
This is an amazing program that actually should be expanded, not limited, and should certainly not have any kind of citizenship test connected to it.
21 states have sued, warning compliance could force Head Start centers to close. Trump is threatening to deploy the National Guard in Chicago, citing high crime and illegal immigration. The mayor calls the idea unconstitutional and says violent crime is down more than 30% compared to last year. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker warns the move is a trial run for a police state. The new Texas congressional maps have passed the legislature but are being challenged in court as a racial gerrymander. Trump says they are, quote, a big win, although California Governor Gavin Newsom is signing a plan aimed to respond in kind. Former President Barack Obama endorses Newsom's, quote, measured approach in a moment of emergency. Arkansas's largest county is updating its voter rolls. Davita Hardin with the Pulaski County League of Women Voters says don't ignore the letter if you get one.
They can respond within 30 days to the county clerk's office. If they don't, then they will be classified as removable. They will be removed from the rolls at that point, and then they'll have to re-register.
Nevada's largest utility is asking for its third rate hike in 3 years. But Camelot Todd with the Nevada Conservation League says NV Energy is being forced to refund ratepayers because of billing errors, which they tried to hide.
They overcharged more than 80,000 customers by $17 million for more than 2 decades, and then tried to avoid full payment of those overcharges by applying the wrong refund rule.
Critics charge the just-released interview of Ghislaine Maxwell shows the convicted sex trafficker can't be trusted about who participated in late pedophile Jeffrey Epstein's crimes. Maxwell told a DOJ official she never saw anyone doing anything wrong. The family of Epstein victim Virginia Giuffre calls that laughable and accuses justice of giving Maxwell a chance to rewrite history and angle for a pardon from Trump. Details remain sparse on the FBI search of former Trump national security advisor John Bolton's home. Bolton, an Iraq war hawk and Trump critic, has faced past criticism over his handling of classified documents. The White House insists criminal charges are on the table and has said it would use the justice system to punish enemies. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
From the University of Oregon's Agora Journalism Center, this is the Listener's Podcast. Welcome back to Oregon Speaks, Voices from This Moment, a special season of the Listener's Podcast produced by the graduate students at the University of Oregon. I'm Andrew Devigal, the director of the Agora Journalism Center and a professor at U of O's School of Journalism and Communication. In this season, we're exploring how Oregonians are navigating this moment of transition through stories of uncertainty, mutual aid, resilience, and care. Let's listen in.
Hello, my name is Dakota Rainey Trapp. I'm your host for this episode, and I'm with my producer, Daniel Bloomfield.
Hello.
Right now, we are facing a crisis in the nation where public broadcast services, or PBS for short, is at risk of losing funding due to the federal budget cuts from the Trump administration. The risk to their funding would impact their programming, which is essential for both news and early childhood education. So to get an idea of how PBS is dealing with this, I brought in a guest, Floyd Aragon of Southern Oregon PBS. Now, Floyd, would you introduce yourself to the audience and tell us a bit about Southern Oregon PBS?
My name is Floyd Aragon. I live in Medford, Oregon. I am currently a producer at Southern Oregon PBS. My job particularly entails producing a show called Cinema 42, which highlights the people and places and independent filmmakers from Southern Oregon and Northern California. Southern Oregon PBS was founded in 1979, I believe. It was a idea of a local businessman, and he and other business leaders in the area decided to try to get public television to Southern Oregon. Well, what do we mean to the community? What is our worth? What is our value to this community? What does it mean to us? And that's something I think we need to reestablish. And I think for some communities, we have to establish that. Funny thing, FEMA was actually supposed to give us a grant, and that's held up, to improve our infrastructure because, you know, the Cascadia quake, we kind of need these over-the-air. If the internet goes down or streaming goes down, you know, a lot of people, their only way to find communication is OTA, over-the-air. And to maintain these repeaters across this large area, you know, that's also one of our kind of our contingencies that we have, that, you know, we need to be part of this over-the-air network because of emergency preparedness. I mean, that's part of what television does for people, too. Forms a community.
But real quick, that FEMA grant is being maintained?
That's still up in the air. I think they gave away the first round earlier this year and we didn't get it, but we applied for the second round and a lot's happened within the last 2 weeks, so we don't know what funding is being cut, what funding is going through. Obviously, he's backtracked on a couple of items of federal funding for different federal agencies. So we will see, I guess.
How was the DOGE federal budget cuts affecting Southern Oregon PBS, or was there any impact there from DOGE's cut?
Nothing immediate, because a lot of our CPB funding occurs every 2 years. So we've already got some CPB funding already. It's we get it in a third of a grant per year. CPB had very specific rules on how the grant money can be made available to us, and it was by doing these underwritings where I think we might have mentioned it before. There's a list of things that underwriters for public broadcasting can't say, like this Sunday doing that and showing prices because it was attached to that funding. Now that funding may be going away. So there, does that mean we can go ahead and now, not really fund ourselves via, a commercial station way? We can get underwriters. We can have people coming in and saying, or run commercials. Don't even call them underwriters anymore. So that's something that we're going to kind of look at.
So those are your biggest donors, and it seems like their donations are conditional. Are the federal funds historically conditional as well?
Yes. In order to be a nonprofit, there are certain things. But now, since it's a media, there are other FCC rules, which might be something you might want to look into too, ruling nonprofit television. And low power. Well, we have a couple low power stations, but they're mostly religious, I think, here, at least in Southern Oregon. I don't know what their rules are for that, but yes, there are stipulations of how we can fundraise. But since we're not getting any more federal funding, then what does that mean? I mean, our license is a non-commercial license. But in the meantime, like I said, we're going to have conversations of what we do in case this doesn't happen. We've got to get on top of this strategy so people are thinking differently. Projects that we might have had in the back burner and thought about, they probably won't happen now.
What is the atmosphere in like right now within the studio?
Apprehension. No one knows what's going to happen, At least giving some awareness. I mean, if anything, this attention has gotten people to think about PBS and what it means to them, So, and like I said, there are strategies to combine, JPR and SOPBS. And if that does happen, it might be 4 or 5 years down the road, we might actually be on the SOU campus, which means, some of us will lose our jobs because there's going to be overlap on staffing.
Yeah, and just for some context for Daniel, like any listeners, Jefferson Public Radio is located on the grounds of Southern Oregon University's campus, specifically in their feeder building. Southern Oregon PBS is located in downtown Medford.
But also bring strategies, too, if we're combining our station with JPR, which is a very strong news station.
So you mentioned the state of apprehension. Is that as a result of the flood the zone strategy that the administration is using against you?
I guess you can kind of call that, it's more like the shotgun blast. We're just getting this news, like, okay, and like I said before, PBS has been under threat before in previous. I mean, the previous Trump administration said something about that, and then you look at Mr. Rogers going in front of Congress in the 70s and establishing the. Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the continued funding. So I don't know if we're going to have those kind of hearings in front of Congress like we did in the 70s, but to everybody that's been in public television for a long time, this threat is real. And I think a lot of maybe old timers or people that have been in the industry for a while, especially on the public media side, kind of rested on their laurels a little bit, like there's no way they could ever take this away. But it's a fragile balance. There are stations like us who depend on that money for operating costs and for just general payroll and things like that. But then there's OPB, KQED, these larger public television stations who basically do the same thing that we do, but have a much bigger budget. And JPR also has a wider footprint. They go up to Coos Bay, so there and further into Reading. So it's the radio has a bigger footprint. which means they have more listeners, more contributors, but you know, it's less costly to run a radio station than it is a television station.
Has sort of any decisions or plans been put in place to help weather through this storm?
But it's, like I already said, there's rumors about that, you know, we might have to close a downtown television station and move on to SOU's campus. So, and you know, that's, we've been in that location since 1979. It's an old building.
Have people been coming out and speaking out in support of your organization?
We've gotten emails. I mean, there's nothing been publicly, kind of, I guess, or editorially. I haven't really seen anything, but our donations are up, and I think that's part of the reaction to Trump's actions, obviously. People are seeing that this is a valuable resource in the community. This is something that, and to your point, they probably did remember the Mr. Rogers and things like that. But this also sort of spurs, if you want to know kind of a change that's happening, it's like, well, like I said at the top of the interview here, we've got to make ourselves relevant. You know, if we're just a pass-through and people can get it, you know, on their PBS app, on their TV or their smart television, you know, why would it matter if Southern Oregon PBS is around? So I like to push our programming. Hopefully this will kind of eke our programming to more hyper-local, as I like to call it. I think Cinema 42 kind of helps that out. That's something that I've been working on, and I'm getting an hour-long show to highlight the films and do interviews, and that, you know, gives it a reason for the kids' parents to watch PBS. You know, even just local filmmakers, and Dakota knows this. I mean, there is a burgeoning kind of community of filmmaking down here, because it's, we're getting people that were, can't afford California, or were, you know, displaced by the Palisades fire. And this, I'm sure Dakota can share this too. It's kind of a retirement for a lot of movie business folks, if you will. We need responses. We need answers to people's questions about this. As just not as a fan of PBS and as an employee. You know, you've got to, you know, we have some sort of comeback when people say, well, I don't know, I'm already going with that.
Yeah, to my understanding, you guys have a campaign of $1.60 annual per person is what it costs to help keep PBS up and running. My next question would be, what is the most realistic outcome that's both the worst case and the best case scenario?
Worst case scenario would be that Southern Oregon PBS would shut down, and we would just be, they'd use our bones for parts, or we'd probably keep the transmitters and the repeaters, and they'd just probably just be maybe a hub someplace in an office building that takes all the programming from OPB and sends it right out to Southern Oregon and Northern California. Best case scenario, we get our funding, we get community support, we kind of, Southern Oregon PBS becomes a stronger brand, and we're able to produce more locally driven content. Joining with SOU, like you said, Dakota, would not be the worst, be part of a worst case scenario. That would probably be a best case scenario, but it sort of also diminishes our independence. JPR, I think, has a more, JPR, for one, is Jefferson Public Radio. So the state of Jefferson, I don't know if you've done any kind of research on that, but it's a fiercely independent, I'm going to say, like, more of a conservative leaning sort of, I mean, they're in Redding, and they're in Coos Bay, and they're in our broadcast region, Klamath Falls to Brookings and whatnot. Their audience is a lot more diverse, I guess, because we have, you know, super rural, I mean, also SOPBS is super rural, Klamath County and Eastern Oregon, more doing farmers. But what a lot of, there's a reason why people are in Oregon. You know, it's, there's fierce environmentalists, but there's also, you know, got the wildfires, keeping our forests, you know, accessible. So you have like conservative environmentalists, and then you have super God and guns, but just want to be left alone. So it's, ours at least is kind of more an education, and then if our news comes from a national base, we don't do a lot of local news programming yet. So JPR in that sense has a more informed, they're more informational for their area. We have a couple programs that are specific to the area, but no news.
You just recently, the other day, had a meeting with your leadership about potential plans and things you guys are going to do. So can you give us sort of a recap of where we left off?
So we had a meeting with our president of the company, CEO Phil Meyer, kind of laid out what's happening in Congress right now. There's a rescission bill going through Congress. It's already been up for a vote twice. I believe it's going to be up for a vote next week. And what that does is it takes the money that's already allotted to CPB and takes it away. So we've had a budget, you know, obviously fiscal year 2025, with this money in plan to pay for, you know, operations and costs and whatnot. To that end, since Republicans aren't getting a lot of votes, and there's been already a couple million responses with the PBS's Protect My Public Media campaign. 50% of preschool children do not go to preschool. So PBS morning, you know, cartoons or whatever, it's part of the, you know, process of rearing an educated child is having access to that stuff over the air. You know, they just pulled a rural broadband internet incentive. So, you know, if people can't afford the internet, which is, you know, a lot of people, especially in rural areas where it just doesn't reach, over-the-air transmission is the only way they get information. And like, we are part of the Emergency Cell Phone Act network and emergency alert systems. And what is going to happen now is we're scaling back some capital projects that we were working on, some infrastructure stuff. And what's happening too is since National Science Foundation and National Education, National Endowment for the Arts, since their funding is being cut, that automatically relates. And I showed you that article about the PBS's public learning. These federal programs, or this federal money that was going to these arts and education and cultural programming, is being, you know, pulled. So you know, this stuff that was supposed to maybe finished up in September, maybe they shot it, and they're just looking for a grant to finish post production, which I think a lot of grants do. That's on hope. We have enough money in reserves to, at our current levels, the way we're spending, to go another year. But we also, in order to recoup that money, we'd have to get two times the amount of subscribers that we have right now, our patrons, or, you know, the ones that give sustainers, you know, $5 a month or something like that. So out of a whole year, you know, it's, I forgot what amount it is. But anyway, we'd have to do, you know, to maintain our current levels, we'd have to do double that. Barring that, we're getting a lot more, just a positive thing. We're getting more large donors, large contributions, because obviously it's being more in the new cycle. So the people that used to give, you know, $2,000 are giving $5,000 are giving $10,000. And we're seeing that within the last couple months. It's a good thing, but you know, it's got to be invested right. It's got to be put into a contingency fund.
Yeah, I'm right now reading like the Deadline article you sent me, and it goes into like one of the things that I'm like right in the middle of reading in this article is the Department of Education and their decision to end the Ready to Learn It grant, which was authorized in 1992 amendment to the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, and that would make sure like corporate public broadcasting and PBS would receive grants at each 5-year cycle, with this latest cycle expiring on September 30th, and that's like coming straight up to an end. And because like the Department of Education like has been completely weaponized,
they don't really set education policy. They're the one that dole out the grants. So therefore, if there's no organization to give out the grants, the grants aren't going to be given out. And it goes back to that Ready to Learn program that got cut. Is, I think I have a statistic here. Right here. P- PBS Kids averages 16 million monthly users and over 350 million monthly streams across digital platforms. But it's a lot of kids, you know, either the parents are going to sit them in front of a tablet, you know, play games or, you know, any distraction. PBS actually has, at least it's, if it's going to be a distraction, it should be at least educational for you, you know, not a TikTok stream or something like that. So.
Yeah, it's like, because it's like one of those things of PBS, like the first thing that comes to my mind in terms of their shows and broadcasting they have, it's always their education stuff for young children. I think like that's the shame, that's like what seemingly is the main target of getting cut, is all those kids focused education shows. Like I even remember like hearing stories like from back in the 80s of where there was like issues where parents would have with cartoons like G.I. Joe and Transformers of how much they're being pushed to sell toys and not doing enough education. And now we're hearing about shows that are pushed to educate children that are now being risk of losing funding.
There is, yeah. It's weird. This the comments that I hear, you know, the comments I've read underneath that, because our president did an interview last Thursday for Kobe, is, you know, why do we have to pay for it? What good is that? And why I don't want my tax dollars going to, you know, left-leaning stuff. And it's just left, empathy leans left. You know, it's not, you know, if anything, we get criticized for being too conservative.
And not, it's not just that. There's also just like this weird lack of just understanding or empathy of how tax dollars work and they not, and just all the things they will go to like, I think, like, it's kind of absolutely weird for some people to have the stance of, why is my tax dollars going to PBS when there's, like, a bunch of other more questionable things that I probably shouldn't be going to, like all the forever wars in the Middle East?
Oh, yeah. Well, our defense spending is up again. So, and it's kind of funny. I think as this all kind of, like, weeds out, it's like we're not finding any government waste. I mean, what's being saved? I haven't heard any numbers on where this money is going that we're clawing back, I guess.
Are you guys like, how's it like looking in regards to potential layoffs for like a lot of this stuff? I'm curious.
Well, if we, like I said, we could turn into a pass-through station, which would eliminate, you know, half of my job and two others. We kind of have to look at doing things like more efficiently, I guess. Maybe cut some, because we do have some part-time people that have been working here for a while. And Phil wants, I think my boss is going to retire pretty soon. The production manager is going to retire pretty soon, like maybe next year. So there's kind of a transitionatory type action already kind of happening. And maybe they just won't hire somebody else to replace them. Kind of, we've got to make us value added. So if we do need to get twice the subscribers, well, then let's kind of look into making more productions, maybe doing more live events. And I would like to do, I mean, I'm going to suggest to do a Patreon model. Say we get behind the scenes of Energy Horizons. We've got, you know, tons of B-roll and stuff like that and bloopers and outtakes, and maybe even have a do a podcast or have a discussion after the Us As We Are sort of, you know, programs that Keegan's doing or all across Oregon, our local productions, have more media or more content link. We've kind of look at, you know, a station is more of just, you know, we're just beaming out content. More, we've got to engage our viewers because it really is. I mean, it's viewers like you.
So there are no local pledge drives is what I'm hearing. Those are all for national.
I think we used to do live. We have a couple programs like the Great Train Journeys or something like that. He comes in and I would like to do more live stuff, but it's safer obviously to do pre-recorded. And it's usually centered around some sort of program that were, I think last pledge was around a nature program and we had little interstitials and KS Wild like had tickets, you know. We do work with local companies, but it's, you know, I kind of would like to get back to the telethon, you know, sort of thing, 24 hours, just being goofy. And, you know, there's plenty of artists and actors here. I'm sure we could do like Shakespeare scenes or have a band, or I think that's part of our, what I would like to bring a local initiative in. So,
Yeah, I was wondering, you're talking about what programs were being affected as far as post-production. I was wondering, are those going to be affecting any of your most popular programming, and what are those programs?
There's three programs that are affected right now. They just start, we have three new programs. I think it's Lila in the Loop, Work It Out Wombats, and maybe Carl the Collector. These are programs that just debuted this year. And, you know, they've been budgeted for the first season, but, and these are really popular programs. I mean, I probably get some Nielsen data on it, but it's, they're in limbo. They can't, you know, like I said, there's a lot of post-production grants that are being stopped. You know, things are made, but they got to be, you know, edited or, you know, sweetened and of some sort post-production. So those are the three in that article, I believe, that are being affected. But it's, there's got to be more, obviously. They're pulling back grants for...
And what about your local programming? What are among the most popular? And are those going to continue?
Nothing's been affected yet. If anything, like I said, it kind of spurred some actions into some people as far as to up their giving. But, you know, our local productions that we need are Us As We Are, all across Oregon. And then we also air interstitials, the work of art, Southern Oregon Responds, and what's the other one? Oh, then my program, Cinema 42, but I mean, I cost nothing, obviously. So there might be, you know, pullback in production funding for that. And I think the what may result into this is the less grant money that usually was available is probably going towards, you know, instead of giving to TV, you probably want to give to, you know, a drug treatment program because their funding got cut. You know, they need the money more than we do. You can probably put that in your own head. But the result, I think giving is changing, and the way grants, what happens with grants usually is they'll tell you about what grant you, like if you're interested in this grant, you write your proposal. And then it's another 3 or 4 weeks before they say yes or no. And you don't even know if you're going to get that full amount. You know, you probably could have applied for $8,000, but they're only going to give you $5,000. So since this government money is drying up, a lot of these nonprofits and social services are going to have to go to the private sector, which kind of, with those foundations and grants from, at least with the government, it was delivered on time. There's a date that it had to be done and that you're going to get it. With these foundations, they could take all the time they want, you know, the mull over, whatever they want. It's like, we're giving you money, we can take all the time we want. So that could have a real impact on public broadcasting, especially for us. If grants are going towards more needed social services instead of, you know, yes, PBS is essential and that, but we're not saving lives. I guess maybe you are with PSAs, but, you know, it could lessen the amount of money that's available for everybody.
All right. And I guess my last question before we wrap it up here is there like a vision you sort of see at, like, or at least some sort of light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, that's kind of what I've been kind of stating before, is that this crisis, if you will, of fundraising and not knowing where our budget is going to come from in the next 2 years has actually spurned more the community to, you know, support or be more aware of public media, and to, you know, that public media campaign has gotten millions of I don't know what portion of from us. I'm sure I'll get those numbers soon, but it's kind of bringing awareness at least to what we do and what we can do and how we serve our community, you know, because, you know, what's complacency breeds contempt in that way where, yeah, it's always going to be there. Don't worry about it. You know, you don't really pay attention to it until it's gone. And I think the light at the end of the tunnel is like, hey, and it kind of boosts our ego too. It helps because, you know, it's sometimes it's thankless. I mean, I'm supposed to be invisible. So if something, the only way I get attention or not attention or the only reason eyes would be on me is because something wrong happened on television, like a black spot or a wrong air. Other than that, I'm invisible, and that's what I'm supposed to be. So, but to get some, some reaction from the community, I think it's been great as far as the reaction from our audience.
All right. I think we're running out of time. Thank you so much for coming by and chatting with us, Floyd.
It's no problem.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
This is Dakota.
And this is Daniel.
From the University of Oregon. Thanks for listening.
That's it for this episode of the Listener's Podcast, Oregon Speaks. Thanks so much for listening and for making space for these voices. This season of Listeners is produced by graduate students in the Community Voices course at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. If you appreciated what you heard, we'd love for you to share it with someone in your own community. And if this kind of community-based storytelling speaks to you, if you're curious about how to create podcasts that builds trust and sparks dialogue, we've got something for you. The University of Oregon now offers a community podcasting micro-credential, a flexible, hands-on program designed for anyone looking to amplify local voices through audio storytelling. Whether you're new to podcasting or looking to take your work further, this might be the next step. You can learn more about this program with a link in our show notes. We'll be back soon with another episode. Until then, keep on listening.
Welcome to Street Roots Radio. This is an X-Ray FM collaboration with Portland local publication Street Roots. Street Roots publishes a weekly social justice newspaper sold by people experiencing homelessness and poverty to earn an income.
I'm joined by Street Roots Snowden intern Grace Mangali to talk about her latest article, Long Fight to Protect the Rights of Filipino Migrants Continues. Filipino migrant workers have faced detention and deportation for decades. Networks of community care are fighting to keep them safe. Well, first of all, thanks for being here, Grace. It's so nice to have you. So could you give me a little bit of a background around this issue, sort of like how long it's been going on? Yeah, we'll start there.
Yeah, for sure. So the issue itself of kind of the abuse and mistreatment of Filipino migrants has been happening since they first immigrated in the early 1900s. And this story kind of came about because my colleague Jeremiah Hayden has written a couple of really amazing stories about the impact of increased ICE presence in Portland specifically. And so this is kind of like my entrance to that conversation, to kind of further contextualize what that really means, what ICE presence really means, what it means to be an immigrant, what it means to be a migrant worker, the conditions that people face to get to the United States alone, the conditions they have to face while they're working, and honestly, like how these immigrant communities support each other, because, you know, for a lot of them, there isn't a homeland, there isn't somewhere to go back to, there's not somewhere safe that they can return to. They came here for opportunity, and I think that, you know, they have every right to be able to take advantage of that, and right now they're being targeted and being forced to go back somewhere that they might never have known. So that was largely the background of the story, and there is a huge thriving Filipino community in Portland especially, and also just all throughout the West Coast, and so they were all really excited to kind of get some coverage and get their story told.
Yeah, I'm always blown away by like how many organizations there are in this like specific community, and just like how sweet and welcoming everyone is. How many Filipino migrants live in the US, and why? What's the root there?
Yeah, so there's about 2 million Filipino migrants. There's probably about 4 million Filipinos, including Filipino Americans. And so a lot of Filipinos kind of initially came over because the Philippines was colonized by the United States between 1900 and 1934. But there was never a huge United States presence other than military presence in the Philippines itself. So Philippines were incentivized to come to the United States as nationals and work in agriculture and, you know, work for, in the same way that a lot of other immigrants worked in the United States. And then kind of around the 1930s, there was a cap on immigration when the when the Philippines, quote unquote, won their independence, which is a very benign kind of loose way to put it, because there was still a lot of effects, kind of like a stunting of growth, honestly, in the Philippines due to United States colonization in terms of just developing the economy and developing industry. And so that has kind of been pretty consistent since then, and Filipinos do migrate to the United States for better opportunities. And there are a lot of Filipinos now, and there is a very, you know, before, you know, the last couple of years, it was pretty easy to come over when you had a family member who was in the United States. And so a lot of Filipinos would send, you know, one or two family members over, they would work and send money back, and then eventually kind of take the path of bringing their whole family over to gain citizenship. And yeah, that's kind of the reason why so many Filipinos are in the United States now.
Thank you. Next, could you tell me a little bit about some of the incredible people in your article and sort of like contextualize what they're going through, what their life's like?
Yeah, for sure. So I was able to attend a Know Your Rights workshop at the Filipino Bayanihan Center in Portland. And it's a little nonprofit that was started during COVID. And a lot of Filipinos in Portland especially can't drive or, you know, had a lot of fear surrounding the pandemic. Obviously, there was a lot of Asian hate going on, and so people didn't want to leave their houses. So they started by delivering kind of care packages and groceries. And then they continued when they kind of realized there was a big Filipino presence in Portland. And so now they offer just kind of a community space, but as well, like, kind of know your rights, know your resources, know your health, know your safety workshops. And so there I was able to connect with a lot of just members of the community who know someone who knows someone who's struggling with this, or, you know, whose family experienced this before. And it's very, very interconnected. And through Santo and Freddie, who work at the Bayanihan Center, I was able to talk to Tita Maria, who is an elderly Filipino Portland resident who claims she's a victim of wage theft. And we actually conducted the interview. Freddie was translating in Tagalog, which was really special. And Tita Maria was, as you know, as much as it's difficult what she's going through, she also has a really nice singing voice and she loves to sing karaoke. And it was a really wonderful conversation. And I think that this article also just goes towards that goal of Straight Roots to kind of repair the relations between people who don't have great experiences with the media. And so just all of the people that I talked to were really happy and excited to share their stories, but also kind of understand the importance and the gravity of sharing their stories with press. And so, you know, there are some folks that are like, I don't know where I'm going to be next year. I don't know if they're going to come get me. And it was a really vulnerable and hard experience, but that's one of the things that these organizations do, is they just like get national attention, and they get attention from leaders and journalists and people who can start actually, you know, amplifying what they've already been doing for a while. And really, like, you know, Tango Migrante, which was the organization I mainly wrote about, has been credited with freeing 5 people from detention, which is insane. Like, just how community support can really make that much of a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Will you tell me a little bit more about Auntie Lynn as well?
Yeah, for sure. So at the Know Your Rights workshop I went to, we were able to kind of watch a video of her release. So she is a green card holder who has been here for a majority of her life. And she's also a lab technician at the University of Washington. So very integrated in the kind of Pacific Northwest community. In the video of her release, she was like, I know my students are here. I know they missed class to come see me. So she's a very valued member of society. And she was on vacation at the Philippines, probably seeing family. And she came back and was detained at the Seattle airport. And she was held at the Northwest Detention Center for 3 weeks. Her family was able to secure legal aid But Tango Bagrande really kind of amplified her story and made it kind of national news that this woman who has no home to go back to is not like from the Philippines, has lived here for most of her life, has grown up here, is like a quote unquote American kid, is being detained. And she's, you know, she's a teacher, she's a helper, she is a valuable member of the community. And as much as that helped in her case, I think that also made a lot of activists realize, like, everyone should have the right to be able to just exist in America. They, regardless of, you know, I think a lot of Asian Americans are so subject to the model minority myth, and you have to be not only good, you have to be great. You have to be impacting everyone. You need to, like, really solidify, like, you deserve to be here. And that's a little bit backwards when you think about it. And so something else that Tango Magrante really emphasized was that everyone deserves this right, and it's messed up that we have to fight for this. I think the experience of Larry Nicholas is one thing. Like, he experienced, you know, mental health issues, and those people, like, ought to be treated with more compassion and more care. And detaining and jailing, you know, people who experience mental health conditions is not really helpful for anyone. So I think that even, you know, someone who is kind of an average everyday, like, father and worker, you know, Maximo Lundino was a auto mechanic worker, just these people who are just trying to exist, I think Tango Magrante really emphasizes how much they just deserve that, and you needn't be, you know, changing the world to just deserve your right to exist.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about the president of the Philippines and sort of like what the reaction to Filipino people needing support has been from their government, their representatives?
Yeah. So it's been a pretty common theme in the Philippines to encourage people to leave the Philippines and send back money because there's no incentive or action really being done to promote an industry other than tourism in the Philippines. And so right now, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. is actually the son of a former president of the Philippines. And he actually recently came to the United States and met with President Trump. And the dynamic, if I could describe it, is very... The Philippine government is pretty reliant on the United States government. It's very kind of complacent and understands that the only way that they're really going to boost their industry, boost their economy, is by working with the United States and sending over workers so that they can have, you know, United States, U.S. dollars are worth way more than one Philippine peso. So the dynamic has always been this, like, really small elite group of rulers and the majority of the people in the Philippines who are farmers who don't own land. So one of the things that, you know, these organizations fight for is Philippine sovereignty. So they want a government that represents them and represents their needs, and really starts to close that gap and boost, you know, the power of the people. The Philippine people are, I'm biased because I'm Filipino, but are just very special and just deserve, you know, a homeland in a country that represents them and deserve, you know, to be able to work and to be able to keep their money and grow generational wealth and all of the stuff that just has not never been afforded to them before.
Yeah, thanks for that context.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then, like, the reaction from the ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
Will you tell me about the reaction of the ambassador?
Yeah,
recently.
The Philippine embassy kind of refused to meet with these organizations. The Philippine ambassador went on the news and encouraged self-deportation, which is essentially, like, if there's any risk of you getting deported, just come home, and, you know, we'll deal with it there, which is just, there's no help being afforded to these people who you know, can't afford, sometimes in some cases can't afford legal aid. And that is the role of the ambassador. That is the role of the Philippine embassy, is those relationships between the United States and the Philippine people that live in the United States. And so holding the Philippine embassy, the Filipino ambassador, and the United States and Philippine government accountable is something that Tango Migrante is really trying to emphasize with their work. And they're doing that by, you know, speaking out and by mobilizing tons and tons and tons of people in America and the Philippines. And, you know, power is only, like, symbolic in some senses. And community power has a lot of momentum. So it makes me really optimistic. I think it makes the community really optimistic when people are able to gather. The International Migrant Alliance is actually holding a conference on August 30th, 31st, and September 1st. So it's coming up next week. And it's just going to be kind of a gathering that, you know, of these organizations in response to the conditions that they've experienced. So they're not stopping at all. And I think that, you know, they're very smart and have the backings of, you know, the Filipino migrants that came before and the activists that worked before them.
Absolutely. The groups that you're talking about in your article are not only, like, you know, representing these people and, like, trying to support folks with resources and advocating for a better government. So they're tackling a lot. Mm-hmm. And they're really strong community networks. Can you tell me a little bit more about some of the different groups and how they work together?
Yeah, for sure. So Tango Migrante is an alliance of organizations because there are a lot of kind of separate ones that members kind of interwork between and will, like, shift membership and stuff. And so, like, once Trump got elected, members of Migrante, which is kind of another overarching organization, kind of started reaching out to all of these organizations and was like, you know, let's work together. And so Tango Migrante really does a lot of the mobilization of different organizations. And I think one of the strengths of this, like, methodology is that you have organizations that specialize in health, that are made up of, you know, former healthcare workers and nurses, you know, Filipino women especially make up a lot of the nursing force in the United States. You have people that, you know, are emphasized on public health, people that are emphasized on education, and then obviously people that are willing to kind of take to the streets and, you know, drive vans up from Northern California to Tacoma, Washington, and rally outside of the detention center. And so that was something else that really drew me to the story, was this kind of unique organization of it and how just organized these groups are and how they unite for one goal and really work with each other and play towards their own strengths and, you know, let other organizations that have other strengths also have space. There's no kind of one way to do it. I think that a lot of the commonalities has to do with providing resources, but then also empowering individuals to join these organizations and to be able to mobilize themselves. I feel like in my research, a lot of nonprofit organizations will kind of stop at the resources. And what's really unique about Tango Migrante is they want, you know, the Lolos and Lolas and the little kids, like, coming out themselves as well, because that's something that they believe in. And so, you know, family members of those detained have joined these groups and feel represented by them, and teachers and, you know, a lot of students, a lot of college students especially, they're working on, I know, groups that are for, like, high schoolers as well. So, I'm extremely optimistic to see how this continues in this model specifically, and how maybe other, you know, organizations can kind of take after them.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like there's so much dispersed power in the group because there's, like, so many different organizations that people are just like, these are the resources I have. This is my community. This is how I'm going to participate. And it's like, it's funny because from the outside, it's hard to tell, like, where to, like, contact for the power, like, to understand who's in charge. Yeah. But I think that's part of what makes it so strong.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Okay. What are some ways that folks can support and get involved in these organizations?
Yeah, so I think firstly, just being kind of an ally in terms of, you know, maybe like take a look at yourself and say like kind of what kind of privileges do I have? You know, de-escalation is something that they really emphasize in Know Your Rights workshops. So, you know, if you have the power to be able to be like, hey, like, what's going on here? You know, or be like, they don't need to talk to you. Like, you don't need to talk to them. Stuff like that. Knowing your own rights is something that everyone should know. And so knowing how to deal with a certain situation, because unfortunately, those interactions, especially between, you know, ICE and immigrants, is just becoming really, really common, especially here in Portland with the increased ICE presence. And so knowing that is super important. I think also the alliances gave a lot of examples of like calling your representatives and sending letters, and, you know, finding out, you know, who's being kept where and calling the judges and calling the lawyers and just saying like, hey, like, you know, I support this. Like, how can you help? And that kind of overwhelming community support is also what just really strengthens these organizations. Getting involved and educating yourself, getting involved in, you know, conferences are held, press conferences are held virtually all the time, all around the world, to just constantly stay updated. And yeah, like the Filipino Bayanihan Center really emphasized, like, their center is for everyone. So just drop by, use the space, kind of immerse yourself, and just be around people who are supporting the same things that you are.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, obviously, I don't know your community or how you're involved, but I'm mm-hmm. curious how it was for you to write this piece on a part of your own community. And yeah, just like how that felt.
So as part of my internship, I have to write ethics cases, and I ended up writing one about this specific experience because, you know, I went to my editor and pitched the story, and I was like, is this okay if I write this? Like, what does this mean? And she really empowered me to, you know, lean into my process a lot during this. And, you know, you write it in the same way that, you know, every other article you really write is written. However, you take the extra step to show up and talk to people face to face, to follow up with people after it's gone out. And, you know, I have family members that are really deeply intertwined in this world. And so I, you know, I leaned on them for support, and I felt like I really engaged with my process during this, and it ultimately felt really empowering. I know that people like came up to me and were like, I'm so glad to see a Filipino reporter, because, you know, this process is my form of activism. Like, everybody has their different form. And so being able to really do that, like, that's my goal as a reporter, is I think that journalism is activism and there's no separating the two. So I just listened to people's stories and kind of treated it, you know, the same way that I would any other story. And, you know, this is a time that this story was really newsworthy and really relevant. And so I'm just so happy that people felt comfortable opening up to me and talking to me. And it ended up just really, I hope that this is just really supplementing their mission. And I hope to write some follow-up stories as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing that.
Go for it.
Is there anything else you want to add to this interview?
I don't think so. I think just continue to kind of be aware and support these organizations financially if you can. Share resources as much as you can. And yeah.
Awesome. And where can folks find this article?
They can buy it from a vendor anywhere throughout Portland, and they can also buy it on streetroots.org.
Thanks so much for your time, Grace. It was great talking to you. Yeah, of course.
You've been listening to Street Roots Radio. You can find this program and past episodes on our website at xray.fm, or listen live on the radio Wednesdays at 8:45 in the morning. For X-Ray FM, I'm Hannah Francis.
You're listening to X-Ray FM. Oops.
Let's try that again. You are listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM.
K296 FT West Haven, serving Portland at 107.1 FM. And K219 KU Nehalem, serving Nehalem, Wheeler, Manzanita, and Rockaway Beach at 91.7 FM.
Streaming live